You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is just about 9 o'clock.
KBOO at the Clinton every second Thursday at 7 p.m. This month, KBOO is proud to show the documentary Queen of the Sun, What Are the Bees Telling Us? The film is an alternative look at the global bee crisis. Before the film will be a short discussion with bee experts on how to help save the bees. That's Thursday, May 8th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along on Saturday, May 3rd, from 3 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. On what would have been Pete Seeger's 95th birthday, his life and legacy will be honored with song, remembrances, and a talk by Joe Hickerson. Again, that's Saturday, May 3rd, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up on One Land, Many Voices, host Zaha Hassan presents interviews she did recently in Palestine with Hanan Ashrawi, Palestinian legislator, activist, and scholar, and Nihad Bokai, a deeply committed Palestinian activist living in Israel. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, will the FCC put an end to net neutrality? Another police killing of a homeless person in Albuquerque, an update on the fight against the building of a mega military base on Jeju Island, and Bay Area students protest the arrival of the president of Rwanda. At 11 on the Radio Zine, host Lisa Loving speaks with writer, educator, and former Portlander Angie Chuang about her new book, The Four Words for Home. And at 11:30, Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey, community organizer at Columbia Riverkeeper, and Eric Wallace, film producer, talk about upcoming screenings of Momenta, a coal export documentary. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for Community Radio. If you're not a current member, you can fix that when you go to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today.
Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices on commercial-free, listener-supported KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. My name is Ned Roche, and this morning I'll be sharing a couple of interviews that my co-host Zaha Hassan conducted on a recent trip to Israel and Palestine. A shout-out is in order to Zaha's film crew, Art Wright and Lee Roche, for recording these remarkable interviews with Hanan Ashrawi, whose powerful eloquence always inspires, and Nihad Bokai, a deeply committed Palestinian activist living in Israel. We begin with Hanan Ashrawi, who was born in Ramallah, Palestine, just before the Nakba, or creation of Israel. Ashrawi was a university student in Lebanon when Israel occupied Gaza and the West Bank in 1967. This momentous event changed the course of her life. Along with other idealistic students, she immediately joined the growing Palestinian revolution. In 1969, she met Yasser Arafat. Since Ashrawi was forbidden to return to her home in the occupied territories, she came to the U.S. and earned a Ph.D. in English at the University of Virginia. Because of a general amnesty, Ashrawi finally was allowed to return to Ramallah, where she joined the faculty of Birzeit University. From 1991 to 1993, Arafat appointed her an official spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Madrid peace talks, where she dazzled the world by upstaging her Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu. Ashrawi became a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council, but in 1998 resigned from the government in protest against political corruption, specifically Arafat's handling of peace talks, and went on to found MIFTA, the Palestinian Initiative for the Promotion of Global Dialogue and Democracy, reflecting her drive to end the Israeli occupation on humanitarian grounds. In this interview, recorded shortly after the celebration of International Women's Day, Ashrawi speaks about the connection between the liberation of Palestinian women and the national struggle of the Palestinian people.
Palestinian popular culture has tended to mythologize Palestinian women. We're either the mother of the martyr or the wife of the prisoner. And yet Palestinian women have been active agents in the struggle for justice and freedom since Zionism first landed on our shores. Would you talk a bit about the history of Palestinian women within the struggle and how it has evolved over time?
Well, that's a tall order because it's going to take a long time to talk about the history of Palestinian women's involvement in the struggle and the Palestinian national identity and the search for freedom, liberation, dignity, and as well as social justice and the system of good governance even under occupation. But let me say, Palestinian women's struggle is not something new. Very few people understand that there was a very active women's movement in the early 20s or even the late teens, 1915, 16, 1920s. There was a lot written about women's rights. Of course, this was limited to mainly middle-class, educated urban women. And most of the women's organizations were really within the, as I said, educated middle class in urban centers and so on. But they also dealt with the women's rights in a very conscious way, mm-hmm. with the suffragette movement, so to speak, the Palestinian equivalent, with the equivalent of Palestinians trying to play an active role in society and in the late 20s. In opposing and resisting the British mandate, and then in opposing and resisting the creation of the State of Israel on Palestinian territory, and in participating in all sorts of resistance movements. Then, with the dispersion and exile, and the dispossession, the uprootedness, the Palestinian experience took on different shapes and forms, whether in exile, and in refugee camps and so on. There was a total disruption, a total deconstruction of Palestinian life. So women took on different roles, having to preserve the family, having to maintain some semblance of life and security in refuge, in places where they were sometimes very unwelcome guests and so on. So it's another story, where the story of uprootedness, of dispossession, of loss of all the frameworks and terms of reference that gave people security. And that was a total, violent, cruel disruption of continuity. Then you had people under occupied, then you had people in the West Bank and Gaza with all the differences of experience and so on. So the normal, let's say, development of Palestinian society was clearly disrupted, and it went in different ways. Gradually, I think, with the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and with the beginning of the Palestinian revolutionary movement, the women took on two different roles. They found themselves in the revolution. There were women revolutionaries, women in the armed struggle, women hijackers of planes, women carrying out acts of violence, but women also formulating political positions and so on. But they were seen as women in the struggle, much more so than women coming unto their own in terms of their own society. They were part of a revolution. That was different. That changed, of course, the way in which women were viewed, but it still maintained a sort of strange context, which is the revolution.
Do you think that having been in that position of reacting to sort of the decimation of the Palestinian presence on historic Palestine accelerated Palestinian women's liberation in a way?
Mm-hmm. It did in some way. It did accelerate the search for liberation and freedom and so on, the fact that there was a sense of exile and dispossession and fragmentation and so on. But it also fragmented the Palestinian experience. It became different types of experience. That's why I'm saying in the revolution, women were outside as part of the armed struggle, the revolution, and so on. And the same as there were women in refugee camps just trying to survive without even thinking about stereotypes and so on, and labels. And then under occupation, you had women beginning the process of resistance through nonviolent action, civil disobedience, through exposing the limits of power, especially military power, as exercised by the Israeli occupation. So while you had outside armed struggle, revolution, and so on, inside you had the emergence of the women's struggle for liberation by nonviolent means, by popular struggle. And I think it wasn't until the 70s that we started, the late 70s, the sort of gender agenda, the fact that women had a specific role in resistance and in social issues and in political formulation. We had, at the time, it was very popular globally, the consciousness-raising sessions, study groups, and so on. We started the first women's rights charter, trying to say that women have a language in common, despite the fact that they might belong to different political factions or parties or whatever, a woman's...
That affects very much sort of the different experiences as well. Their village versus the city.
Exactly. So we thought there has to be a commonality, a common woman's voice within a sort of gender approach to women's rights regardless. This was very interesting, and it began, of course, also among educated people in urban areas, but it managed to get to grassroots organizations and spread into camps and villages. It was amazing. And we used to go and have seminars and town hall meetings and whatever in different places, and open public meetings talking about women's rights. And the public was very receptive, because we made the link between national oppression and the denial of the Palestinian people's right to self-determination and freedom and dignity with the liberation of women at that time, and with the denial of women of their rights to freedom and dignity. And we found this linkage with the right to self-determination. Yeah. That if the whole nation was fighting for its right to self-determination, you cannot withhold that right from the women, and that it's the same principle, the same struggle. We were told, of course, at that time, you have primary conflicts, you have secondary conflicts. Yours is a secondary one. Our primary conflict is the occupation, national oppression. We have to get rid of those, then we will have time to address social justice, women's issues, and so on. And we said that's not true. They are part of the same structure, the same system, the same mindset. Yeah. If you do not accept your oppression on a national level, you will not accept to oppress people on the basis of their gender. So that's how we made the linkage, that this was just as primary and just as immediate, that this contradiction could not be postponed. And it's
that
not
brings
secondary.
Up, you know, there seems to be two trends going on with women in Palestine. There's this trend that, you know, we're seeing more women obtain higher education and enter the professions and enter politics, and you know, that very positive role of women within society. And yet we're also seeing an alarming trend where women are, we're facing more domestic abuse and feminicide crimes.
Yes.
And how do you explain sort of these two trends, and are they related in any way, and what's being done to sort of combat that?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, Palestinian life is extremely complicated. And therefore, when you live in an abnormal situation, whether it is expulsion and exile, or whether it is the oppression of occupation, military occupation and oppression, you are not living freely on your own land, able to take decisions, able to mobilize and so on, articulate an internal agenda as well as an external political action agenda and so on. So an abnormal situation like the occupation quite often intrudes into people's lives and generates certain abnormal types of behavior. For example, one of the most noticeable things we saw is the fact that the use of so much violence against people, the destruction of the systems of security. In Palestinian society, it's the family It's the clan, it's the tribe, it's the community. This is your source of security. And then there are structures, the parents, the grandparents, the parents, the children, the extended family, and so on. These are the structures of safety. That's your safety net. That's your protection. When, take one example, when the army enters your house, manages to beat up your father, beat up your mother, arrest your brother or sister, destroy everything in the house, and leave. And the child looks at this and knows that he or she has been robbed of the things that other children take for granted, that your father is humiliated and is helpless, that your mother has been, again, publicly insulted or even beaten up, that you're not safe even within your own home. There's a sense of resentment and anger, and there's a feeling by the parents that they could not provide the children with their sense of safety. So violence and a sense of frustration, anger, helplessness enters into people's lives. Loss of bearings, loss of anchors. So the men who are frustrated, who feel in some ways, some of them could feel emasculated even, who feel that they've been humiliated in front of their own families in a male-dominated patriarchal society, internalize the violence, and quite often they use violence. And they take it out on the women and children. So violence found ways of entering our lives in very abnormal ways and means, and destroyed, in many ways, the fabric of society, what holds society together. So that's one aspect of the occupation. On the other hand, we have a very active, intrusive, critical, not just women's movement, but civil society. A factor of this injustice, you end up having mobilization and empowerment of women, particularly within institutions and structures that are there, particularly to protect women, to empower them, to find ways of giving them a platform and a means of action. So along with the fear for the women and the children and so on, and the violence increasing and so on, you also have an increase in awareness, empowerment, mobilization, and solidarity, and so on. And at the same time, this violence against women emerges from a long-term tradition of linking the family honor to women's behavior, particularly sexual behavior. So using the whole frame of honor, the pretext of honor, lots of crimes are committed against women, some of them having nothing to do with honor, frankly speaking. Many of them having to do with inheritance, with rights, and so on.
Or with rape and trying to cover
up. Or with rape and covering up. And quite often the rape can be incestuous mm-hmm. within the family. So it's, you know, it's multiple injustices that are taking place. And because within the inherited legal system, mitigating circumstances and so on are used in order not to punish the guilty, in order to justify femicide, in order to call it a legitimate form of cleansing your honor by killing the woman. Many men resort to that, including, let's say, somebody who wanted to marry the woman from the same family, or her uncle who wanted her to marry his son, or whatever. They use violence against women. So we have the whole spectrum. I mean, in Palestinian society, you have the most active, independent, outspoken leadership women, and you have the most silenced, voiceless, oppressed, marginalized women.
Sometimes women are complicit in causing that.
And everything in between. Right? Sometimes, look, I mean, I don't want to go to Frantz Fanon and tell you the wretched of the earth, that many people, the oppressed, don't understand the nature of their oppression, and they can become complicit. It happens in their oppression. You don't expect every victim to be totally aware of the nature of the victimization. This happens. But that's why we need empowerment, public awareness. They need to feel they're not alone, and they need to have the courage to question inherited assumptions. Two things are always used against women. Traditions, which involves also the question of shame and honor and so on, and religion. So we have to rescue these two. We have to rescue our culture from normalizing incorporating violence against women and injustices to women, and we have to rescue religion, whether it is Muslim or Christian or whatever, from being used as a pretext to oppress and discriminate against women.
It was very hopeful to hear that in the case of the woman, from the 32-year-old mother of six from Aqaba that was hung from a tree and killed in a femicide case, that the judge of the Islamic court came out and condemned that and said there is no such thing as, you know, Islam justifying killing for honor.
Exactly.
And yet the law hasn't seemed to catch up to even the religious establishment.
Because in Palestine you've inherited laws from other places. In Gaza we have laws from Egypt or laws dating back to the British rule and so on. In the West Bank we have Jordanian laws. Now we started in the Legislative Council since 1994 to begin to legislate new laws for Palestine based on the basic law, which is based also on the Declaration of Independence, that you cannot discriminate on the basis of gender, ethnicity, inability, whatever, origin, religious affiliation, and so on. So we legislated on that basis, and we had a very active women's movement that was really, that exercised not just lobbying, but oversight on the work of the legislative. Unfortunately, with the division and the rift, since 2006, the whole legislative process has come to a halt. The Legislative Council has not been active, has not promulgated laws, but we ended up with laws by decree from the president. At first, the president tried not to resort to that, not to have the executive become the legislature simultaneously, but unfortunately, we had to. So he started passing laws like that from the cabinet and so on. There were two laws that we were working on that dealt with these issues. The penal code, which is the code, the law that allowed for such a treatment of women, and the civil code, the family law, as we call it. These two, there are draft bills that have been drafted by consensus, let's say, by civil society organizations, by women's movement, by the legal movement in Palestine. Even we brought in even some religious leaders so that they could be also advocates of this kind of justice. And these are good laws. I think these are good bills that can be passed, that should be. Unfortunately, they haven't been passed because they have to be passed by decree by the president. And he wanted them to be reviewed by the cabinet, and Son wanted them to be reviewed by his legal advisors. He wanted them to be reviewed even by religious establishments like Al-Azhar. He sent the first law to Al-Azhar to review it. So the process was very long, and it wasn't taken seriously, frankly, by all these different people that were reviewing it. And at one point, because of one case, like the girl from Hebron, the student, Aya Baradei, she was killed by her uncle. She was thrown in a well. There was such a tremendous outcry. People were really infuriated. And how come the law has not been passed, or how come you did not amend the Jordanian law, the penal code that we were working on? So immediately, and there was a demand, not just by women, by all social institutions, civil society, NGOs, everybody, that you have to, at least if you're not passing this law, at least amend the existing one. So he did, in a sense, nullify or cancel one of the major articles that allowed for the use of violence and femicide against women. And that honor is not a mitigating circumstance. You do not get a lighter sentence because you killed a woman to preserve your honor. That was one, but there were other articles in that law that should have been amended that weren't. So we still pursued. We have a national coalition to combat violence against women. There's a national coalition for 1325, again. There's, and we just set up a national initiative now, not just a coalition, to sign an honor code. And we said there is no honor in killing women. But you have to sign a code, whether you are in the executive committee of the PLO, which is our highest political body, or whether you're a member of the cabinet, a government minister, or whether you head a human rights organization or other civil society institutions, you're an opinion maker, or whether you're a legislative council member, and so on, that this has to be a commitment to legislate.
A change of culture.
Yes, and to work. Look, the first Intifada in particular served as a transformative experience, a really, really transformative experience in terms of culture and shame and honor. Because we are definitely an honor society, not a guilt society. It's what people will say. It's your shame, and you will be shamed in public or not. So with the first Intifada, women came out, women, young girls and so on, were acting within the resistance movement, were heads of neighborhood committees and popular committees, took risks. Women also headed the demonstrations and protest movement and so on. So we transformed the concept of shame and honor from the personal behavior of a woman in a conservative society to doing your national duty, so to speak. It is shameful not to resist the occupation. It's honorable to resist the occupation. Huh? It's shameful to collaborate with the Israelis, but it is honorable. So the whole focus shifted. And women found a space within the political, the national, the resistance movement to redefine their own sense of value and to move beyond the restrictions. And they found role models. I found many women who come to me and say, whenever, you know, members of my family tell me I can't do this or I can't do that, or I say, Hanana, shall we can do it, so can I. That to me was the greatest, you know, sense of vindication of what I've been doing, that there are women who can use role models, who can resist, as I tell the Americans, not just glass ceilings, but stone walls, brick walls around them, and who can find their way, you know, to making themselves heard and to making a difference in Palestinian life. And they did that at a great, great cost. So that transformative moment was enormous. Then when the PA was set up and there were governments and there were rewards and fruits and whatever, the competition became very vicious. And the men felt that the women were taking away something which is rightfully theirs. So the patterns of political control and behavior reemerged. That this is the man's domain, this is a male responsibility. And women, you can go back to the kitchen or you can work on issues of human rights and social justice, but you cannot work within the domain of decision making, whether in politics or economics. So we found ourselves with a new battle on our hands. And we did wage this battle. We had, of course, many supporters among the enlightened men. And we mobilized within civil society and so on, and within, of course, the political domain. The fact that I'm in the PLO executive is also an expression of women's mutiny, because they rebelled against the deal that was made by the men. And they decided they want women and they want elections. So it's the first time you have real elections in the executive committee. And you have a mutiny by the women who elected a woman. They asked me to be their candidate so that we can break this male monopoly. Mm-hmm. So, okay, we have women everywhere now, but it's not enough. We haven't reached parity or equality, and we're still within social concepts and traditional attitudes. Women are still discriminated against.
Long way to go. It's a journey.
Yeah, so you still have. So you have now, because there is greater frustration, there is a lack of achievement, accomplishment in the political arena. This finds a way of expression by regressing to traditional patterns of behavior and by exercising violence against women. So as women are making real strides ahead at, politically and so on, and economically and in civil society, you have the other extreme, where you have the reemergence of early marriages, and because this happens in times of threat and insecurity. the way to protect your daughters is to marry them off early. While we have now the religious establishment accepting that the minimal age is 18, we find practices now that are violating that and going back to early marriages. While we are working on new legislation to protect women, and there is a very active social outcry against femicide and so on, and concerted effort, you have an increase in incidence of femicide. So these two trends are going hand in hand, and we're trying very hard not just to connect, but to eradicate this regressive trend, the sense of fear and insecurity and hiding behind traditions and so on, and to empower Palestinian society in ways that would give women their rights and equality, freedom, dignity, whatever you want. The problem is we still exist in an abnormal situation. I don't blame everything on the occupation, but when you are robbed of your freedoms and your rights and your land and even your need to hope, and when you have walls surrounding you in a state of siege and so on, it's very hard to get people to focus on the well-being and the health of society, because the aberrations, the abnormality of the violence, the oppression, the injustice is there before you every day. And it permeates every aspect of your life. And it generates behavior that is not entirely acceptable or conducive to justice towards women or other people, because we're living in a framework of captivity and injustice.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. We just played an interview with Hanan Ashrawi, recorded last month in occupied Palestine. When we return, Zaha interviews Nihad Bokai, a Palestinian activist living in Israel. You're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM. The drums and chants you just heard were recorded in Arabe, a Palestinian village in Israel, on March 30th during this year's Land Day commemorations, jointly held by the villages of Arabe, Dir Hana, and Sakhnin in the Galilee. The roots of Land Day go back to 1976, when thousands of Palestinian citizens of Israel gathered to protest Israeli government plans to expropriate a large swath of Palestinian-owned land in the Galilee. In the resulting confrontations with Israeli police, six Palestinians were killed, hundreds wounded, and hundreds jailed. Over the years, those events have become consecrated in Palestinian memory as Land Day, as it was the first act of mass resistance by Palestinians inside Israel against the government's policy of expropriating Palestinian land. Our next interview is with Nihad Bokai, a Palestinian artist and writer who lives in northern Israel and formerly served as coordinator of research and information at Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Refugee and Residency Rights. Nihad spoke to Zaha in his office in the Galilee about the need for Palestinian citizens of Israel to see themselves as part of the Palestinian nation.
In 48, we have like our own circumstances inside Israel, because all the Arabs inside, Palestinian Arabs inside Israel, faced different kinds of discriminations concerning education, concerning occupation, concerning economic, socioeconomic status, unemployment in the Arab-Palestinian towns. But the most critical problem that the Arab-Palestinians inside Israel now face, specifically in the Arab-Palestinian towns, is the overcrowded towns. Because the state of Israel don't permit to the Palestinian to just have their own houses. So this thing lead to another socio-economic hard conditions inside the towns itself. For example, we see that the crime, for example, is raised recently, and face, for example, another different types of political environments in the villages and towns. The political discourse that it was before two decades, for example, I mean, the national awareness among the Palestinians now, it's just like going sides.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's more like talking about living conditions and more talking about what kind of problems that they face in the daily life. But I mean, the national discourse is now is like really have different meaning than it was, for example, before 2 decades.
Even with the talk in negotiations, for example, of late of the Jewish state, doesn't that feel threatening to the Palestinian citizens of Israel? Wouldn't that make them want to re-engage politically because that could really affect their status in the country?
Well, you know, I mean, the state of Israel deal with the Palestinians inside Israel in a way how it can control the Palestinians. What kind of mechanisms the states can do to control them and to put them sides from the whole Palestinian conflict and the whole Palestinian issue, you know. So this is the main purpose of the state of Israel. And all of the policies, the governmental policies toward the Palestinians is going on this way, you know. I mean, it's economic, political, even in the education, in every level of the life, this is the main issue that the state of Israel want to do with the Palestinians in Israel. And you know, this thing will have results with time, you know. I mean, not all of the Palestinians for sure will have the same national awareness concerning the conflict, for example, or concerning the policies of the state of Israel, what the state of Israel do with us as Palestinians inside Israel. So this is normal. I mean, in the way of countries, for example, even the US, how the US government, for example, deal with Indians, or how other countries, for example, colonial countries deal with the native people in their states. So it's normal. I mean, the way the policies itself is normal, but also the results of these policies, it's also kind of normal, you know. You will find people who share the conflict, who share the struggle of their people, and you find another people who don't care, you know. They want just to live, and they care about, you know, the daily concerns.
We just came back from Araba, where we saw thousands and thousands of people waving the Palestinian flag. It's surprising to hear that there's just people that are, you know, just want to live, just want to have a good job, nice home. Is that even possible, though? I mean, what limitations are there on Palestinians in terms of jobs, in terms of, you know, getting housing?
You know, I will tell you something. Even when you will talk about the solution of the conflict, you know, I'm not like so afraid about the whole issue of the conflict, the solution of the conflict, because I know that the racial policy of Israel will not allow to implement such a solution to the conflict. You know, even if you will find a Palestinians who will go to give up their rights and to go toward Israel, you know, Israel will not allow to them, you know, because, and this is the same thing with the Palestinians inside, you know, even if you will find Palestinians who want more to focus about the daily issues, the daily concerns, but even as I told you, even if you just like look to the, for example, to the to the daily issues, for example, the housing conditions, or for example, education or employment or anything, you know, concerning the daily rights. So Israel have the same treatment with the Palestinians, you know. So at the end, by the end, you will reach the same result.
So can you give us examples with respect to housing for Palestinians of the challenges that they face in obtaining housing?
Well, you know, I mean, now, you know, the Interior Ministry didn't allow to Palestinians to just like have houses in the villages, in the Palestinian villages. So any Palestinian young, for example, who will get married and he will, you know, want to have a house in the village, almost he will not have, there's no lands, you know, to build a house.
Why not?
There is no, you know, because
you
most of the lands are confiscated, right? It was with the states. So the state, for example, give the towns, I mean, divide the lands between the towns. But even the state, if the state didn't give a town these pieces of land, how this young will build the houses, for example? So all of the Arab Palestinian villages and towns inside Israel, all of the towns and the villages face the same problem. Almost there is nowhere to build a house now in
so
the...
What do you do?
Well, you know, I mean...
Is everybody living in the same place? I mean, how
do... Well, I mean, this is what I told you. I mean, this kind of thing that say all the time, that these Arab towns and villages will become with times like refugee camps. If you will look to this town, for example, after 20 years, I promise you will find a refugee camp. It's not like just refugee camp concerning houses, but also like all of the consequences concerning, for example, rising crime, concerning hard socio-economic conditions. All of these results that related to this housing problem will raise also.
Because of the high density. And so people have to build up. Are they allowed to build up, you know, floors to their homes as much as they can, or?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is one of the solutions. But others, for example, that they are built without any permits. So then you are facing another problem, which is the house demolishing. And also the tasks, which is so so high that they pay. So if you look to the cost between building a house or having a house in the Palestinian Arab towns compared with the Jewish Israeli towns, which is so different from living conditions. So the house in the Arab Palestinian towns cost even two times, or sometimes three times, compared, for example, with Haifa, which is a nice city, and you know, so it's so expensive. And this is a problem that all of the young people, the young Palestinian people, face now, you know, because how a young Palestinian people who go to the university, like, and then he will start his life, how he can, for example, pay half a dunum, which is cost something like 1 million shekel, which is 1 million shekel is... Yeah, in addition to the cost of the house itself, to build the house.
Can they move easily to a mixed city like Haifa, Yaffa? Can they get housing there? Do they have to leave the village?
Well, not in all the places the Palestinians can live, you know that. I mean, even, for example, a lot of Jewish cities, you know, you know, didn't allow to Palestinians to live in this. But also, like, another thing is, like, concerning to the culture, because, you know, I mean, we are Palestinians. We have our own culture. We like to live in our culture. I mean, it's not like just to go to a Jewish city and then, you know, to deal with a Jewish culture, which is, like, in a lot of times, it's, you know, deal with you as a stranger or as a enemy. So why we should do that? I mean, it's a normal right, you know. If we will not talk that all of these lands is belong to us, I mean, it's not belong to the country and not belong to the Jewish people. So it's our land, and we will, and, you know, we are announcing that we will pay the price. This land that the country, the state of Israel, confiscated in 48, and the country didn't allow to us to pay our land, you know, that it confiscated from us. So it's really different and difficult
situation. Tell us about, like, the history of your own town that you live in right now, like how your family.
Well, I'm from a village called Chab. And Chab, for example, was depopulated in 48. And all of the land in Chab was confiscated to the state of Israel. So no one in Chab has his own land because all of the land was confiscated. And all of the people of Chab who live in Chab has, after they come back, I mean, after the war in the mid of the 50s, in fact, has to pay their own land, you know? I mean,
it's their own property.
It's not exactly their own property, but I mean, any property in Shab, they have to pay it from the country, from the city.
Are the people of Shab from Shab today? Are they the original inhabitants of Shab?
Well, half of the population from Shab itself, and we have half, they are internally displaced like me, like my father and my mother.
So your mother and father are not originally from Shab?
No.
Where are they from?
My father from Edamun village, and my mother from Me'ar village, which is nearby villages to Shab. So
what happened to those villages?
Well, also they are depopulated in 48.
Do they still exist?
The houses, you mean?
Yeah.
No, the houses, no. No, the houses not exist, and these villages are announced as military closed areas. So, according to law, even you have no permit even to visit these villages. And this is like really a strange situation, specifically for the people who live in the villages. Because like me, I'm a third generation. I mean, I lived in Shab. I was born in Shab, but like my father, which was like far from his own village, 5 minutes. But in all of his life, he didn't visit Damun any time.
What would he see if he visited Damun?
Well, I mean, Damun itself, you know, I mean, all of the houses are destroyed. Yeah. But I think it's like a kind of thing related to that he didn't want, like, really to see his village as a destroyed villages. This what I think. I don't know.
Did you see it? Have you seen
Finland? For sure.
What's there?
Well, I mean, now we have like the cemetery. It's still remaining. Part of the cemetery still remaining. Not all. And that's it. I mean, all of the houses are destroyed. For sure, I mean, I cannot, like, know where, for example, my grandfather's house, where is it exactly in El Damun, because it's all destroyed.
What's there, though? Do they plant over it, or what do they do in Damun?
El Damun is still empty, in fact. I mean, there is no, like, kind of settlement on the village, but I mean, most of the other Palestinian villages, you know, you have a Jewish settlements on it. But the moon itself, it's still empty. I mean, there's no any kind of settlement there.
And it's how far away from your shop that you live in?
5 minutes.
Just 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's 3 kilometers. And you know, I mean, these people is not only you know cannot go to there, but you know, I mean, there's no, they don't have any kind of rights. I mean, concerning to their village or concerning to their properties. I mean, my grandfather, my father's mother.
Oh, your father's mother.
Yeah, so he was Malek. Yani he has like thousands of dunums. I mean, in the whole area of Mi'ar village. And
mother's father had
yes
had a lot of property.
Yes, so and this was before 48. Mm-hmm. So this land, for example, it's cost millions. I mean, it's not like just like we are talking about, like you know. So
how do you feel about that? I mean, do you feel like you still want to expect to get that back, to have that restituted or be compensated for that? I mean, Do you feel that?
Well, you know, I mean, myself, in fact, you know, maybe because I'm involved in the national struggle and like have a kind of a national awareness about the whole issue of Palestine. So maybe because of that, you know, I am like deal more about the collective problem than the individual problem, because for sure the individual thing is like this thing, for example, myself, which pushed me more to get involved in the whole national political struggle. But again, I mean, as I tell you, I mean, they confiscated land. And they deal it with the Palestinian Arabs inside Israel, and with the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and with the refugees in the diaspora. Not because my name is Nihad, but because I am a Palestinian who live here, and so this is the main issue. So I don't think the individual problems of the Palestinians will be resolved without resolving the whole issue of the collective.
How do you see that getting resolved? I mean, do you see that resolution within reach, or is it something that you feel is going to be festering for many, many years to come?
I don't think, I mean, in the short term, I mean, we can have any kind of solution, because as I told you, I mean, even if you will find Palestinians who will have the ability and the willingness to resolve the conflict, even if they give up their rights, but Israel will not allow to them, because Israel, I mean, is based on a racial principle that guide the whole Israeli policy toward the Palestinians. So I don't think the Israel, for example, will accept to build Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. Even, you know, you will have a lot of Palestinians who accept that. But Israel will not allow to them.
If the Palestinian side said, we accept the Jewish state, we renounce the right to return for the refugees, Israel would not accept that.
Well, Israel will find another thing to demand from the Palestinian to do, you know? I mean,
they need to be based on...
What?
They need to have this racial...
I mean, even if the Palestinian, you know, accept now, I mean, tomorrow, Abu Mazen, you know, just announced that I accept Israel as a Jewish state. So in the next day, you know, Israel will find another demand, you know, that the Palestinian should do. I don't know what, I mean, concerning to what, but I mean, this happened all the time, you know, and... The demand to accept Israel as a Jewish state. Why Palestinians should do that? I mean, why? Why this demand should be to the Palestinians, who are the victim of the whole Israeli policies since the beginning of this century. Why? Why they should do that? Why Israel didn't demand this demand, for example, from all the international community? Why specifically they demand from the Palestinian to do that?
Why? Answer that.
I ask you. Why? Why? Because, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you know, to resolve problem, and sometime you will, you should compromise, you know? Sometime, you know, you should go to toward the another side, you know? But not, I mean, just like to defeat your side, the other side, and just like to announce that the another side, the victim, should announce in front all of the world that I am a defeated man and I have no such collective rights. Why we should do that? I mean, even Abu Mazen, which is like a kind of a person who go toward compromise with Israel, even Abu Mazen cannot do that. So what you should expect from the others? The thing with the Palestinians inside is that we have this culture that we know that Israel want to just like push us from here. I mean, this is like the main policy of the state of Israel. And a lot of Palestinians, even if they have like hard conditions, they insist like that we are like, we will stay here because this our land, you know? So this is like kind of a consensus inside. I mean, even if sometime, you know, we have like a kind of different opinions, but at least in this thing, you know, we have consensus. And as I told you, because I don't see a solution to the conflict in the short term, because Israel will not allow to this solution to be implemented. In the future, I think we should develop our struggle inside and to know exactly what we demand specifically from the state of Israel, which is so important, to know exactly what we demand, because, you know, I mean, so this one point. The second point is that inside Israel, when we are talking about national issues, for example, dealing with the state of Israel, we have in most of the issues, we have kind of consensus, you know? But if we have like a strong leadership inside and we have awareness, which is, for me, is very important, awareness that we inside are part of the Palestinian people in the whole, in the whole context, in the West Bank and Gaza, inside Israel, in the diaspora. We are one people. And our solution will be resolved when all of this problem will be resolved, you know? If we have this discourse, so I think it should be better in the future.
You've been listening to an interview with Nihad Bokai, a Palestinian artist and writer interviewed by my co-host, Zaha Hassan. On behalf of Zaha and myself, Ned Roche, thank you for listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Stay tuned now for Air Cascadia with Chris Andre.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59 a.m. Coming up, as Ned said, we'll be hearing from Chris Andre with Air Cascadia, followed by Flashpoints at 10:15. And after that, at 11, Radio Zine with Lisa Loving. And at 11:30, we'll hear from Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey and Eric Wallace, respectively, community organizer at Columbia River keeper and film producer, and they're talking about upcoming screenings of Momenta, a documentary about coal export. Thank you all UK Boo members for your generous support for community radio. You'll have an opportunity to continue that tradition coming up soon. And for folks who have not yet made that move, you can do so right now. Beat the rush at kboo.fm. Click where it says donate today. Stay tuned.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park on North Brandon and North Kilpatrick Streets in Portland.
The Earth Day 2014 theme, Reverse Migration, will focus on local culture and businesses. Over 100 sustainable businesses and organizations, including KBOO Community Radio, will participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of